That, but that vague dream, and I don't remember it. The other one, which of course Freud would have a field day with, is the one about needing to go to get somewhere down a flight of very either greasy or broken or somehow narrow, slippery stairs, and clinging onto the banister and slipping, sliding, falling, and being absolutely terrified. That's a lot more supposedly common dream. But still unpleasant, and I'm still having that one, by the way. Every now and again, that one will just pop right up, and I've had it since I can remember. Now, another thing that's happening to me in the present time of my life is that most of the dreams I do remember are taking place in or around in the same building as my mother's apartment, which was the one I was talking about, the one I grew up in for 22 years. And my mother died almost 2 years ago. It'll be 2 years on August 15th. And for the first 6 months to 9 months to maybe a year, the dreams dealt with her, with me being in her apartment and her being there. And I was talking to a friend of mine whose mother died quite a while ago, but it was so hard on him and hurt him so much that he's still pretty messed up about it. And he has the same kind of dreams where he's in the house and his mother is there, but he can't see her. Like, she's making noises in the next room, and you know exactly what she's doing because you've heard those noises all your life. Or, like, he goes into a room and she's just left it because he can see her shadow, like, in another room. So mine started out really being there with her, and they have dulled or dimmed over time to where she's not even any longer, like, just in the other room or making noise running the bath or the shower or the doing the dishes or making mommy noises cooking. But I am always in her apartment, the apartment I was in, my apartment for 22 years. And I would really like to be able to set up some different scenarios for my dreams. And I think that one of the underlying things is that I never really have felt at home anywhere else. And I've lived in three, four, five, six apartments since then. At least six. I may not be remembering one or two. And I've lived in different boroughs, and now I live in a whole different state. I've lived with different people, with different pets since then. I mean, it's 14 years since I left that house, that apartment. And somehow, I guess I have never really felt like I belonged in any of these other places. And that's why I keep setting my dreams, staging them, so to speak, in this place. And that's what a couple of years of therapy will do for you. You really do analyze what you're doing and why you're doing it. It's kind of neat, actually. So they're not beautiful dreams that I have. They're very, like I say, utilitarian. They're like going in and cooking food or going in and moving furniture, very utilitarian, proletariat kind of dreams. And Robin Morgan in this book, and I mean, she's always more than brutally honest about her own life. I'm sure she has really had these dreams. These are not inventions of hers. These are real. And she remembers them down to the tiniest detail, and they're very creative. I could write songs and stories and poems out of these dreams, one, two, three. But it seems that my creative process depends more on observation, waking observation, and then spinning fantasy or filling in details from that observation. Like, just for example, a made-up example, I will see a glass, like a bar glass, sitting on a windowsill. Actually, this has really happened. Sitting on a windowsill of a tenement window, say, down in the East Village. And obviously, this is a real glass. It's not plastic. They didn't just go and buy this in the corner deli. They took it out of a bar, whoever had it. Or even better, see two of them. And then use that image somewhere in my writing and take it from there. Who the people were who left it. This is an event in their lives where they went to this bar, they walked out with the drink still in hand, so engrossed in conversation, and they left the glasses on the windowsill when they went off together, whatever. So I see things when I'm awake. I don't see them when I dream. Now, one of my favorite writers, besides Robin Morgan, is Anais Nin, and I did a show dedicated totally to her couple weeks ago, and I was reading over some more of her short stories in Under a Glass Bell, which is one of her collections of short stories, and I don't think there's one story in there that doesn't have something about dreaming, whether it's a metaphor or whether it's about an actual dream or whatever. It's so interesting. So I have two of those short stories to read, if I possibly have time. It's 5:40 in the morning now, and this particular piece will take me at least 40 minutes to read, but it's a lovely read, and I think you will like it. It is called Dialogue with the Dream Self, An Anatomy of Dreams, is the subtitle. It's Chapter 3 of The Anatomy of Freedom by Robin Morgan. And why don't I just start right now? The chapter starts off with two quotes, and I will read them. Ships at a distance have every man's wish on board. For some, they come in with the tide. For others, they sail forever on the horizon, until the watcher turns his eyes away in resignation, his dreams mocked to death by time. That is the life of men. Now, women forget all those things they don't want to remember, and remember everything they don't want to forget. The dream is the truth. Then they act and do things accordingly. That's by Zora Neale Hurston. Once, I dreamt I was a butterfly, borne joyously on the currents of the air. I did not know who I was, but I delighted in living. Then I awoke and was indeed myself. Did I dream that I was a butterfly, or did the butterfly dream that it was me? Is there a distinction between a butterfly and myself? Is there a transformation? That's by Chuang Tzu. And here starts the chapter. Dream self and waking self are engaged in a dialogue in the space-time on the far side of a two-way mirror. They are sipping skull-cap tea from small green cups as they converse. Now and then, for exercise, dream self juggles two blue apples in the air for her sister to try to catch. It's so lovely, so very lovely to have you here. I get lonely for you, you know. It seems we hardly ever see one another. Oh, come on, you see me almost every night. I see you, oh yes, but you rarely see me. Really see me, I mean. And see that I see you. Well, I had no choice. I had to risk this visit. You're getting rather pushy lately. Don't you think vivid would be a fairer description? Very well, vivid. I don't mean to be judgmental, but recently it seems to me that you're losing all sense of subtlety. What are you afraid of? to dream and then return to reality only means that our qualms suffer a change of place and significance. I believe Colette wrote that, when she was what you call awake. Look, I've never denied you. I've always respected you, in fact. You've been very generous to me over the years, and I'm grateful. You've given me rich and strange metaphors for poems, plots for stories, insights into my own fears and desires. Why, I've always been fascinated with you. You're indispensable to me. One only recognizes as indispensable something that one has first considered dispensing with. Nonsense. I wouldn't dream of it. I mean, I just mean that I need to function, after all. There are appointments to be kept, deadlines to be met, conscious thoughts to be thought of consciously. Your raw material can be revised into poems only when I'm fully awake. I have political commitments. I have a husband, a son. There are letters to be answered, telephone calls to be returned. I have responsibilities. I lead a full and fulfilling life, a useful life, one with which I'm content. You could be bounded in a nutshell and count yourself a queen of infinite space were it not that you have good dreams. No, no, it's only that I feel you're trying to take me over. I can't afford to go about in a half daze, you see? I'm useful in my place, you mean. Nothing conscious likes to have its place defined for it, you know? I'm to exist in the ghetto of your sleep, to be remembered only if and when it's convenient for you. You are to interpret me. You of all dreamers should recognize a clear case of oppression when you dream it. Yes, well, I see your point. That makes me nervous. When the oppressor catches a glimpse of the point of the oppressed, that's usually the moment when the oppression intensifies. Dreams grow holy when put in action, you know. Adelaide Proctor said that. Of course, she lived in the 19th century when women dreamed most of the time. Then again, she was a poet. So am I a poet. Yes, dear, but you live in the 20th century, when scientists know all about dreams occurring mostly in REM sleep phases and can chart brainwave activities, adrenaline flow, heartbeat rate, and changes in erectile tissue in their touchingly sophomoric search to discover what in hell it is that I'm doing. Although at least they've gone beyond the hilarious Freudian interpretation that everything I showed you, from how to fall painlessly down a spiral staircase to how to fly, was a secret code for sex, and that every protuberance, from a young pine tree to a nose, was really a penis. Darling Freud, did I ever tell you that I knew his dream self quite well? She found him so dense. Jung was far more interesting to his dream self, and I agree with her. He showed some poetic flair, some imaginative style, some reverence at least. Although he got a bit flaky at times. You needn't parade your erudition. I already knew you were bright. Acknowledging that I'm bright is no substitute for acknowledging that I'm real. Did you know that the Senoi people of the Malay Peninsula base their so-called waking existence on the message of their dreams? That's what I call respect. The Senoi children are taught to confront and engage hostile dreams, to converse with them, to call on friendly dreams, to let themselves enter fully into their dreams. They are taught to return from a dream with at least one creative idea. If, for instance, they're flying in a dream, they should try to fly somewhere to bring back a song or thought or image to share with the rest of their people the next morning, like a gift. These ideas then become part of the culture and legacy, part of the very administration of the tribe. I might add that the Senoi are a very peaceful people, with a society rich in dance, poetry, and music. They're highly egalitarian and claim to have had no violent crime or intense conflict in hundreds of years. But that's a whole society. It's all very well for the Senoi, and I do envy them, but I live in a totally different culture. A culture that relegates respect for dreams to the realm of the artist, the idealist, the occasional therapist. My culture places an inordinately high priority on being wide awake. Since when did profound social change not begin with one dreamer? And whatever gives you the idea that you're awake when you have the idea that you're awake? How can anyone imagine freedom when she's still trammeled in a tedious old wake-sleep duality, the basic fallacy of all the fallacious dichotomies that enslave? Besides, who would ever give up the reality of dreams for relative knowledge? Alice James wrote that. She dreamed a lot, but then she had little choice in the matter. I prefer being wanted to being needed. Will you stop quoting? It's maddening. What else is madness but a waking dream? Novalis said, we are near waking when we dream that we are dreaming. Sorry, but I retain these things. Somebody has to. You tend to forget a great deal. I know. And please do believe me, I'm not ungrateful. It's only that, well, yesterday I dropped one of my contact lenses and I couldn't find it. Lost. Last week I left my wallet in a taxicab. Lost. The week before that I thought all day Tuesday that it was Monday and missed a dinner date with a woman who was in town only 2 days, all the way from Burma. This is me. Neat, orderly, compulsive, dependable me. It's appalling. How can this be happening? I'm just not like this, and it's your fault. I've been thinking about you, mulling you over, sleepwalking through my days, thinking about you as if in a dream, dwelling on how articulate and loud you're becoming. So you drop a few stitches, blur a few details, so what? I never let that sort of thing worry me. I always feel it's the general direction, the overall message that counts. Besides, for what being are you trying to prove yourself blameless? I don't know. You just dropped one of those blue apples. Good for you. Here, have a fresh cup of tea. Waking self sips her tea slowly, sitting in dumbfounded silence. After a respectful pause, dream self continues. It could be her, of course. I mean the one you're trying to be blameless for. But naturally, you know that. Remember the time she was dressing to go out and you were helping her? You were about 10 years old. She was standing in front of a mirror, putting on a chic little black hat with a tiny veil. The two of you chatted amiably, and you followed her all the way out to the elevator in the hall of the apartment building. It was only when the elevator door opened and you saw the shocked expression of the people already inside it that you realized you were on your knees, had been all along, had followed her out to the hall on your knees. Oh, God, another mother dream. Yes, you hit me with that one just last month. Was it so very awful then? No, I suppose not. It was almost funny, in fact, although a bit obvious. Not at all like the one about her death. So you remember that one after all this time? Oh, I am pleased. I must say, I thought you and I worked rather well together on that one. You were notified by phone that she had died. There's no shock at the news. I've been prepared for it, expecting it even. Or so I think. I go to the hospital and automatically, stupidly, to her room. Of course, the bed is empty, the mattress rolled for airing, the bed springs exposed like unrustable bones, or like brown-painted snakes uniformly coiled for dancing in a precise corps de ballet to unheard music by some unseen Indian flutist. At the nurse's station, I am told that I will find her remains, euphemistically, downstairs. With horror, I realize that I must descend into the hospital's morgue. The way down is via a series of elevators, escalators, and winding ramps. The corridors are all of beige-yellow tile, reminiscent of routes to prison waiting rooms. I find myself saying aloud to no one, it's in the bowels of the building. An involuntary terror suddenly realizes that this is a dream and tries to wake me. Yet I seem to make a conscious effort to dream on. I fight, in fact, to continue dreaming. I enter the room. It is very like the butcher room behind the meat counter at the supermarket. A young male attendant is on duty, clearly bored with his work. The nurse's station has alerted him to my coming, but I give him a coat check stub anyway. He leads me past carts and tables with bodies on them, untidy, sprawled, undraped, some clothed or half-clothed, some naked, but all of them absurdly wearing socks. That was a nice touch, I thought. It's those little details that give me pride in my work. Hush, don't wake me yet. The smell of antiseptic masking a kind of burnt, sugary odor is ghastly, and the disorder is appalling. It's very cold. Some of the corpses are actually moving. They twitch and writhe. The attendant explains offhandedly that this is a process of muscle spasm due to decomposition. Like flaming strips of paper arch and curl in the fire, you know? I barely believe him. We come to where my mother apparently is. He works at ropes and pulleys to lower her on her tray, which is like an autopsy drain table surface suspended above us. All the while he explains that they're overcrowded and are forced to hoist some up to the ceiling. As the tray is cranked down, I am again shaken by a fierce desire to run away, but again desperately refuse and make another conscious effort to continue dreaming. She is sprawled out, relaxed, smiling. Her facial expression makes her appear younger. I can't reach her head. Her feet are swung toward me with those omnipresent socks on. So I bend to kiss her knee, forcing myself to do so, but also wanting to kiss her. The skin feels like frozen metal, not merely cold, but searingly cold. When I kiss her, though, she rolls onto one side, claps her hands like a child, and laughs with delight. Her eyes remain shut, but she continues to stir as one sleeping. She murmurs, "Did you manage to get the rings and the cash out of my apartment before they sealed it?" Nausea rises in my throat, but I answer yes, lying hurriedly, sickening that this is her first question across the borders of life, that she is still obsessed even after death with concerns about money and property. I seize her hands and pull her roughly to a half-sitting position. How light she is. Loosing one hand, I reach to give her the Wiccan fivefold blessing. But I have no oil, so I must use my own saliva, touching and retouching with my trembling fingers her skin and my own tongue. I give the blessing as it is in my own version, as in the self, touching her forehead, her breasts, her groin, her knees, her feet, all at the same time holding her upright with my right hand. And this is the blessing. Blessed be my brain, that I may conceive of my own power. Blessed be my breast, that I may give sustenance to those I love. Blessed be my womb, that I may create what I choose to create. Blessed be my knees, that I may bend so as not to break. Blessed be my feet, that I may walk in the path of my highest will. She opens her eyes and interrupts me. "I'll repeat your blessing after you," she says somewhat irritably, "but only if you say the Shema with me." Thinking the situation now so cosmically ridiculous as to be amusing, I swallow and nod agreement. Together we intone Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, Omed Tzero. And that, of course, is the Hebrew daily prayer, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. Blessed be his name for all times and unto all generations. Amen." The rancid irony in her demanding of me collaboration in such a patriarchal and nationalistic prayer. Oh, Mama. But then I see some faint glimmer reflected in the dullness of her dark rose corneas, and I whisper intensely, "Look at me. Look, catch the light living in my eyes. Oh, look." Instead, she glances around slowly and asks, "Are all these others adopted too?" I hear myself answering, "All, by the great mother of life and death." "Oh, then it's all right," she replies. Encouraged by this, I again urge her to stare into my eyes until we dare envelop the whole room in light. I cry out, "Receive your daughter," though I cannot tell whether I am addressing her about myself or calling to some other about her. She breaks into a radiant smile and then falls back limp, uninhabited. I step back reverently. The silence hums. After a pause, I manage to ask the attendants, unjokingly, "Does this sort of thing happen often?" "Oh, yes," he shrugs, laconic as ever, "if you're lucky enough to get here before they stiffen. Death's a process, too, you know, not just life. These things are gradual, all of them." And he creaks her tray up again in jerks, so that the embalming fluid sloshes a bit over the side. Now I can at last give way to my desire to wake up. Now there is no more reason to continue the dream. It is finished. "That was beautiful and brave. I'm proud of you. And perhaps it's just as well that you never told your mother about that particular dream. She might not appreciate it. I do. But, oh, darling, footnotes? That was a bit disappointing. It's so wakeful." What do you mean? Is it contemptible to explain? To clarify?" "Not at all. When you awaken from the state of dreaming that you call being awake, when you realize that being awake was all a dream, then everything is explained. Everything is clarified. When you understand that life may be a delusion, that fearing death may be like longing to sleep late on a rainy morning, that dying actually may be like drifting gradually awake on a pale green summer dawn, then everything needs no explanation. Everything is exquisitely, humorously clear. But it's not done with footnotes, my love." But if I want to communicate with another, shouldn't I be responsible enough to seem blameless? How could you possibly explain the time Sylvia Plath was shampooing her hair and turned around to give you her own diamond collar, a flat, glittering necklace that was really faceted from ice, as you realized once you fastened its freezing beauty around your throat? It began to melt, didn't it? Or how could you possibly communicate the knot of tiny scum-brown worms all writhing around the unseeable yellow sunflower at the center? How can you clarify the moment when you and your husband kissed, and there was blood on the lips of each of you, but neither could tell whose blood it was? Will footnotes help you there? Oh, my God, I'd forgotten those. The time he tried to commit you to an asylum, the time you tried to plunge a sword into his heart, or for that matter, the time his body streamed with light, the time he floated easily beyond the tidal wave you feared, smiling beneficently and calling for you to join him in the lagoon behind the storm, the time you ignored a hothouse of blazing tiger lilies and yellow iris and insisted on entering the flower arranging competition instead with an arrangement of a single withering black tulip surrounded by four stalks of wheat. You were well aware that so bizarre an entry didn't stand a chance of winning, but you were defiant, saying, "Bright flowers all wither, too, and come to the same end. But a black tulip, even a dying black tulip, is very rare." I watched you after you'd convinced yourself you'd woken up from that one. I watched you analyze the black tulip as your love for him.
Wasn't it?
I know what you thought. It would be nice if, for a change, you knew what I thought. Well, was it? You know as well as I do, of course. But I rather assumed the black tulip was your own pride in the negativity of your love for him.
Pride in my negativity? Why on earth would I feel that?
Hasn't it won you gold stars on the Women's Movement chart of approval? Didn't you, for a while there, shift from wanting to be blameless where he was concerned to wanting to be blameless where other feminists were concerned?
Now, wait a minute. That's terribly unfair. I mean, yes, I shifted, something like you say, but that's not the whole story. For one thing, I have felt deeply, truly negative about him sometimes. Hating, despairing, so filled with pain of him that I had no idea who I myself was or might be. You know that better than I do. It was you who showed me the handmaiden of the holy man. It was you who breathed him out as a tornado that shook the whole house while I carried our naked, sleeping child out to the street, fighting the gusts with every muscle and tendon in my body. It was you who had me refuse to stop him from committing suicide by jumping out of the speeding car. For that matter, it was only in your presence that he kept turning into my mother. Do restrain yourself, dear, from all this accusation. It was you, it was you. As if you and I were separate. It's tedious and unworthy of us. But that's not all. There was the light. There was the lagoon. I've also felt more love for him, more recognition, more love and recognition from him, more soul twining, if I can call it that, with him, than with any other human being, with the possible exception of our child, which is different anyway. Besides, you blithely overlook another area where something sure as metaphor is going on. It hasn't all been groveling approval-seeking from other women. Remember when you helped me fight a whole collective of hardline Central Committee-type women who had kidnapped the child because they wanted to save me from the oppression of having born a male child? Remember all the dreams about the special one woman I loved more than any other woman and who I thought loved me? Remember when she twisted my arm in a restaurant so hard that she broke it? Remember when she got married in a subway car and rejected me as matron of honor, and I sat there mortified and hurt while the ceremony proceeded, reading a subway advertisement that bore a photo of me with the caption, "Extra."